It went straight down the middle. Then it started to hook.
Welcome to another edition of For the Good of the Game and Bruce Devlin. For our 78th interview this morning, we've got another LPGA major champion with us.
Well, you do. She's got a lot of other attributes, too. Loves photography, is quite good at it. Does some art murals. Been a teacher at a golf club in Rancho Mirage for the, I guess, 30-some, well, maybe not teaching all the time, but there for 30-odd years. And the winner of the 1969 LPGA Championship, along with four LPGA victories. And it is indeed a pleasure to have Betty Burfine here with us this morning. Thank you for joining Mike and I.
Thank you both. I appreciate it.
So, Betty, as you know, we've talked about, we're here to tell your life story. And as I understand, your roots go back to New York, New York. So tell us about life growing up as a child in New York City or in New York area.
Well, yeah, I was born in Manhattan, but we didn't stay there long. We moved to New Jersey, Wyckoff, New Jersey. And I'm not sure how old I was. Then my parents divorced when I was nine. And my mom, my sister, and I, we moved to upstate New York. She knew a good friend up there, so we settled right there and had our house built. And we were in the woods in the rural area, and it was called, at that time, it was Spencertown.
Uh-huh.
And then we moved to Cana, which is just one mountain over. It's really the same area.
Yeah.
And that's basically where I grew up, high school. Played golf in Massachusetts. Well, we're real close to the border there.
Yeah.
So like 2 miles from the line. And I played all my golf in Pittsfield, Massachusetts. And that's where I developed more golf, more errors, more whatever.
Well, how did you get exposed to the game of golf at a young age?
My stepdad played. And he wanted to get my mom to play again because she played too.
Okay.
But gave it up for a while. And that's when I started. I got my clubs, Patty Berg specials.
Yeah.
And I played at this 9-hole golf course where my stepdad worked at GE in Pittsfield. And they had this golf course, GE Athletic Club. It was 9 holes, no bunkers. No trees, just some short grass out there every other 200 yards.
Yeah.
And that's basically where I learned. And I played a lot of best ball tournaments with a friend of mine who also played at that golf course. So we grew up together playing a lot of tournaments, mainly best balls.
You know, we talked to all our folks about, you know, they're all great golfers, obviously, but a lot of them have history in playing team sports too, and you were quite an athlete in your young days. Basketball, volleyball, softball, field hockey. Goodness, that was you were busy.
Yeah, I couldn't play golf though. I tried to join the men's team, and they wouldn't let me. So we just had an intramural team that we played maybe once a week, and the season's short up there. I played in Cortland, just south of Rochester, which just had the PGA.
Right.
So the snow flies early.
Yeah.
In that area.
And late.
Yeah, it comes early and stays late.
Yeah. So all the athletics, I assume when you picked up the game of golf, you were already playing some other sports?
Correct. Yeah.
And what got you gravitating toward golf at some point?
Well, I couldn't continue the sports I was playing in college after I graduated. So I was getting real interested in the game, and I was getting down to a low handicap. And I studied phys ed in college, so I had to get a job. And I said, well, let's go down to Florida, and then I can continue practicing while I teach. And I taught for a year and 2 months and then resigned and decided I'm going to join the tour. I've had it. Let's do it.
Yeah, well, before we let you turn professional, we'll still come back to some of your early days. How did you get some of your early teaching? Is there one teacher in particular that really stands out?
I never had a lesson until I joined the tour.
Isn't that amazing?
So how did you learn? Were you a pretty good visualizer? Did you have good observation powers?
I learned visually, yeah. Right. And I teach visually too, most of the time. But I kept wanting to be paired with the best golfer at the club. And he was a young guy. And why not to copy the best one? He was like a two or three handicap. So I hung out with him and learned as best I could. So that was the beginning.
Any TV watching? Any favorite that you like to watch?
Always. Always watching. Jack Nicklaus. Yeah, of course.
his name comes up quite often, I might tell you that, too, as you can well imagine.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, great player.
Pretty good swing to mimic as well. But what about other visual ways of learning the game? I remember at least when I grew up back in the 60s, it was the golf magazines. I'd clip out all those one-page illustrated lessons, and that was kind of my scrapbook for chipping. Yes. I had a section on chipping, a section on driving, a section on putting. Mm-hmm.
Good. I did the fold-outs.
Yeah.
Had a swing sequence.
Oh, yeah.
So, Betty, Mike can do a lesson now in chipping, too. He's one of those one-hand chippers. If you,
oh, I could,
you
I could
probably
take
didn't
a lesson.
Know that, but he is.
that's what you do when you can't chip with two anymore.
Yeah, right. Just as good as two. Why not?
That's right. You go with what gets you results. Anyway, so tell us a little bit about how your game developed. Self-taught, observing, as you say. Did it just sort of develop gradually, or were there some step changes at certain ages where you really picked up something and got better at?
No, it was just gradual. I didn't have any epiphanies that I could think of. It was just gradual, working on it, practicing a lot, hitting a lot of balls. I worked at this club in Pittsfield, Wakona Country Club. Tommy Toski was the pro. And that allowed me to practice there and play without having to pay.
That's good.
But the practice range was small, and you had to shank your own balls. You had to go pick them up.
Yeah.
So it made me want to hit them straighter, so I didn't have to spray them all over the place.
So you probably had your own shag balls then, too.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Bagful. Yeah. Right.
I remember Al Geiberger telling us that he put nail polish on his balls to distinguish his from others.
Good idea.
Yeah.
Well, that was the beginning of having to mark your golf ball, wasn't it?
Yeah. Well, it sure was. Yeah. You mentioned sort of the lack of opportunities for women back in the day, as you can imagine, having talked now to probably 31 of your peers from the LPGA Tour. They share the same stories, at least the ones that are of the later vintage. They share the same stories about pre-Title IX, no opportunity to play high school golf, maybe on the boys' team, maybe not. In college, no women's teams. Maybe they got to play with the men, maybe not. It was just a different time, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, it was scrape anything together you could find, So, I wanted to join the boys' team just because they played at a country club. Yeah. And where we played for the college intramurals, the first hole of the green behind the green were a bunch of cows. So you can imagine what kind of course this was.
So after your teaching in high school, the high school phys ed in Florida, you just said, okay, I'm going to go to the tour. That was in 69?
Yes.
Yeah. So fill us in on the early days on the tour.
Hear that? That's the sound of a walk-off albatross, a two on a par five to win a two-day golf tournament. That shot happened to me, 1 in 600 million odds. Since then, people call me Albie. Now, I've told this story so often, my friends can't take it. I'm pretty sure my wife, next time I tell her, she's going to leave me. So I decided to start a podcast to tell the entire world about it because it deserves it. It's the craziest shot you've never heard of. And guess what? There's tons more stories like this all around golf. And that's what our podcast is all about. Join me and my fellow degenerates, Panda and Shepherd, as we dive into them. Insane bets, crazy what-if scenarios, and all the you-had-to-be-there type moments in golf. Find us wherever you get your podcast. Did I tell you about my albatross?
Well, I was scared out of my mind. The first tournament was in Wheeling, West Virginia. And I think I finished 17th.
Oh, that's remember pretty good. Playing
with, well, there weren't many at that time. Betsy Cullen, I remember playing with her. So that was the beginning, and then on to the next. So, but I might put in here that for me to join the tour, I asked my parents to sponsor me or to give me some money to start. And they didn't really want me to do it because I didn't have dedicated income, constant income, and they were fearful of that for me. So my grandmother gave me $500, and that's how I started. That was a lot.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the path you went down to get to the tour sounds a lot like the path that a couple of our guests just from the past couple of weeks followed. Geraldine Britz taught as well, physical education, 5 years in high school, 3 years at the college level before she turned pro at a little later age. And then Sandra Palmer was a teacher down in Arlington, Texas for a year before she went on the tour.
Yeah. Well, it's just a means to an end.
I
love sports, so I majored in science, but I didn't want to teach in a classroom. So
So
phys ed was fine.
Life on the road in those early years. You have some pals that you kind of caravaned with back in the day.
Oh yeah, we had our caravan. We had the one in the middle, the one in the front would, and we had CBs also.
Yeah. So. Oh, okay.
We would let people in the back, Smokey on the right, watch it, you know. And we had little signals to let everyone know I need gas or let's stop to eat.
Yeah.
So we'd do a fill up, and empty.
Yeah,
fill up and empty.
The empty was the most important one.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So what was your CB handle?
Putt-putt.
Putt-putt. You get the putt-putt here, huh?
Yeah. Yeah, what's your 20?
Yeah, I remember that. You remember that song that came out about CB years?
Oh, yeah.
You're going Convoy. Convoy.
That was it.
I heard that on the radio this just the other day, and it reminded me of some of these discussions we've had with you lately. Your CB radios and caravaning from town to town.
Well, and it was a safety factor for women. I thought it was traveling. You know, we had a way to communicate with someone if we were in trouble.
So, Betty, you said you didn't have your first lesson until you went on the tour. So, fill us in on who was that person?
John Rivolta.
Oh.
Who was the first teacher in 71. So,
he's
for 2 years.
Touched a lot of people.
Yes, he did. And he had hands that were so big that he could take his right hand and his back to the hole. Chipping or pitching, hold the shaft, my shaft, and he chipped blindfolded and darned if it didn't go in. I mean, he could do that with such finesse. And I just go for the ride and say, oh, do it again, John. That felt so good. Do it again.
Very interesting.
Yeah, he was good.
His name's come up a lot on
this
discussion. So I'm sure he did touch a lot of lives. You had a health issue that first year on tour. How did that impact you?
Actually, it was in 70, second year on tour, going on to the third maybe. I had a hyperthyroidism, and it was bad enough where they had to operate and take it out. And they only took 4/5 of it out and left. Whatever they left, I was good to go and didn't need any medication for a couple of years. But it kept me off tour for... 6 weeks. I mean, I was going crazy.
So how long did it take you to sort of get comfortable out there, you know, having learned all the courses, known how to get to all these cities, just to, you know, sort of what life was like on the road in the LPGA tour? Did it take a while?
I think a couple of years. I always had that nervousness on the first tee and never did get rid of it. And Mickey Wright said, good. If you're not nervous, you better leave. Yeah. You're not going to play well.
I agree with her.
Yeah. So.
Well, let's talk about win number one, Bruce.
Yeah. Birmingham, Alabama.
Yeah. Good old Birmingham.
Yeah.
Crazy course. I like that place. Yeah. And
two over Merle Breer. And we believe that was the inaugural event there at that club. I think Centennial Classic at Green Valley Country Club.
Oh, yeah, Green Valley, right. Yeah. We played there a couple of years.
Ah, yeah.
Yeah, the second year I lost a playoff.
Yeah. To win.
Yeah.
Against a lady we mentioned earlier, Sandra Palmer.
Yeah.
On that one.
Right? Oh, sorry. No, that was to Gloria Arrett, wasn't it?
Arrett and Clifford Ann Creed.
Yeah, Clifford Ann Creed and Gloria end up winning that playoff, right?
Yep. She made birdie and Clifford and I lipped out. She won.
Well, by the way, before we come to that first win, because we want to talk a little bit more about it and what your memories are of it, your name has come up a lot on our podcast. Did you have a lot of second places?
Yes, I did.
Yes, well, there you go.
I did.
There you go, because your name's come up an awful lot.
Yeah, I had a lot of seconds. Two playoffs, both lost.
Yeah.
Lost them both. Second.
Yep. Don't feel bad about the playoff losses, though, Betty, because we've kept a running record of all of these great and wonderful players that we've talked to over the last couple of years, and they all, men and women, most of them have a negative as far as winning. They lose more than they win, which is quite remarkable when you think about it.
Yeah.
All the great players.
Right. It's a game of small failures that you have to handle.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, it's mostly about losing as opposed to winning, golf is.
How you handle it,
yeah.
Exactly.
But what do you remember about that first win in 1972 at Green Valley at the Birmingham Centennial Classic?
72, I think it was.
Yeah.
I do remember a few holes toward the end. Actually, when I made the turn, I was three behind. And I think Carol Mann, Pam Burnett, they were up there. But I birdied 15, 16, par 17, and scraped a par in on 18, and I won by one, I believe.
Yeah, actually, I think it's by two over Merle Breer. You finished with a 71 your last round, so you must have had a pretty good back nine then.
Yeah, I was in trouble on the front because I was behind by three. So I had to catch up somehow.
Yeah. So what's that feeling like to bag that first win when that last putt drops?
It's just something that most people don't get to experience. And I was fortunate enough to win that one. And I was staying at a private home that particular week. So that became a habit every year with those people. So it was kind of a tradition. Just going to town, going to that town and winning the first one. I remember what happened coming home to the hotel. You have chauffeurs from the tournament take you back to your hotel. He ran out of gas.
Oh, my.
He's flagging down anyone who's coming from the club. Say, I need to get her to the golf course. hotel.
That's funny.
Poor guy. He was so embarrassed.
Well, you didn't wait long to validate that first win. You know, a lot of our guests wait years to do it. You waited 2 weeks.
I got to say, that was harder than the first win. I think your second win's harder because you have to prove yourself.
Yeah.
But it was at Desert Inn in Las Vegas, and you're playing with celebrities. Every day there was one celebrity with you, with the group, for the leaders. And I was playing along pretty good, right in there, hanging in there. Bounced a ball out of a pond up on the green. You know, everything was going
by. There you go.
Yeah.
And the last day I played with Sammy Davis Jr. and Judy Rankin.
Yeah.
Sammy Davis couldn't have been nicer. The poor guy was late to the tee. We had to give him a ball, a tee. The guy had to bring his shoes. It was just a riot. He was so wonderful. And at the end, he said, you know, Betty, I'll teach you how to dance if you show me how to putt.
Is that what he said?
I'm up on it.
Well, he loved the game, of course, because he put his name to the golf tournament up in Hartford, Connecticut there for a while.
Yes.
He was a big fan of the game.
Yes, he was. Absolutely.
Well, as long as we're on the subject of celebrities, let's talk about some of the other people you had a chance to play with.
Let's see. I played with Ray Bolger.
Sure, yeah.
Peter Falk.
Columbo.
Joe DiMaggio.
Ah.
Gary Morton.
Well, we played in the winter all the time. We played.
Did you?
In Palm Springs. He lived in Palm Springs.
Yeah.
George Schultz. And I regret not getting a little scribble of one Snoopy or Charlie Brown or something.
What a talent.
Yeah.
What a talent wonderful. That man had.
Yeah, so not the Secretary of State, but the famous cartoonist.
Correct, Peanuts. The cartoonist.
Yes, yes. Right.
He used to live at Pebble Beach at one point in time.
You did?
No, he did.
Oh, okay.
You're talking about Schultz?
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, he used to have a place at Pebble.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, he looked okay.
What was Joe DiMaggio like to play with? What kind of golfer was he, first of all?
He was average, but he was very quiet. He hardly said anything.
Yeah.
No.
I remember sitting with him for the second half of the Super Bowl in New Orleans that the Bears won, Super Bowl 20. And kind of a long story, but I ended up sitting with Joe DiMaggio for the second half. That was a great experience.
Did he talk to you?
He did, yeah, okay. Yeah. But you sort of had to engage him. He wouldn't necessarily initiate it, right?
Mm. Correct, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that had to be fun. Of course, the Desert Inn, great old place. It no longer exists.
No. Nothing but casinos now, I guess.
Yeah. A final place for win number two. That was by four over Kathy Ahern. So it must have been a relatively leisurely walk up 18 for you.
Never. You know that you're going to be nervous anyway, no matter what.
Yeah, I can't remember if there was water on that last hole or not, but if there's water involved, perhaps you would be a bit more nervous, right?
There is water, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was par five, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah, par five. But I had no idea I was leading by four.
Okay.
We didn't have scoreboards then. So it's just word of mouth. If anyone could get by you and say, you're leading by three or four, whatever. But no.
And you gotta trust your caddy that he's getting the right information from somebody else. Yeah.
That caddy, he was a local boy, and he didn't know golf at all.
No.
He was just a toter, toter.
Yeah. Yeah. How often did you find that before, I guess at some point just after that, the LPGA started allowing professional caddies, but I think in 1972, they probably didn't yet. How often was it that you just basically had a bag carrier?
Almost every week until, well, after my second win, then some of the guys would want to approach me and say, can I caddy for you?
Yeah.
So I had two that were pretty steady over the years.
Yeah. So you went from winning your first tournament, you know, was it a fluke? Was it? Can I repeat this? 2 weeks later, validation. That had to feel really good.
Yeah, yeah, that did. And it was a long, long tournament. I mean, with the celebrities and Buddy Hackett was one of my celebrities. And he had been causing trouble with the other players in previous rounds.
Mm-hmm.
So,
such as?
Oh, he'd act silly and interfere with what you're doing and making snide remarks. But the sponsors came to me before we teed off and said that if he bothers you, we're going to pull him. Carol Mann shot 76 with him, and she was really upset.
Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Bruce, did you ever run into that, Bruce? I mean, Betty, in case you didn't know, Bruce played with Dean Martin for 10 years in the Clambake, and of course, you know, to bring Crosby. Were there any people causing issues, Bruce, back then?
No, not really. You know, I mean, some of the guys might. You know, it's a real attitude thing, though, don't you think, Betty? You know,
absolutely.
I mean, if you have a rapport with them, even if they get a little bit, you know, off color with whatever it might be, you know, if you can handle that, some people can't. You know.
Yeah, I just stayed away. I kept away from
it. That's good. That's a good way of doing it.
Yeah.
I guess an example, Betty, for us would be We remember some of the crazy antics of Bill Murray at the Bing Crosby or at the Pebble Beach. Mm-hmm. And we talked to Scott Simpson last week on the show, and Scott played with him for years and years and absolutely loved adored it. The guy.
Yeah. I know, he loved it. He had to have loved it to be with him that long.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so he just sort of embraced it and took it for what it was, and they had a great time together, you know?
Well, that's a good attitude, right. Mm-hmm.
So you mentioned a couple of the playoffs, and before we get to those, just mention to our listeners that Betty was named Golf Magazine's Most Improved Golfer in 1972. So what was the basis for that? Give us sort of the background in terms of 71, 72, what happened?
Well, I was scoring a lot better, maybe 2 or 3 strokes less than the year before. Plus, I had won the 2 tournaments, so that was mainly the reason.
Yeah.
You don't mind getting that once, right?
And then, I got it once.
And then you want to maintain that lower average score, right?
Yeah.
Although Steve Stricker did, I think he was a comeback player of the year 2 different times in his career.
Yeah, phenomenal.
So who knows?
Yeah.
So we go to 1973, and you'd mentioned a couple of the playoffs you're involved in. The first one being in Pompano Beach Classic. That was at Pompano Beach Country Club, and that was, as you'd mentioned, a playoff with Sandra Palmer.
Correct.
And Sandra is one of the more recent inductees into the World Golf Hall of Fame. We visited with Sandra briefly, lost internet connection, and we'll pick it back up with her tomorrow. So what do you remember about that tournament?
I remember having to birdie the last hole. That got me in up on top. Sandra Palmer hadn't come in yet, so it turned out that she came in and we tied and went to a playoff. And that's the one shot I regret, was the second shot on that hole. I hit it into a bunker. Sandra was on the green, about 20 feet. And I was in a bunker that it looked like dogs were having a heyday in there. Footprints all over the place. And I was in a footprint. So you got to figure it out and do something. I got it out, but Sandra birdied anyway. So
was it a par 5?
No, it was par 4.
It was par 4. Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. Yeah.
That's the worst experience is the nervousness on a playoff. It's just, it can be good news or it can be failure that you'll never forget.
Well, as Bruce has mentioned, we've found through our research that these playoffs seem to be nothing more than a coin flip at the end of the day.
Yeah, it is luck and whose day is it? You know, they just people have their day, and you can tell they're going to win, or you just know. Gloria Arrett had been playing pretty well up to then, so she made birdie on that first playoff hole.
Yeah,
was in Birmingham.
Again, this was the one at Birmingham. That's right. Mm-hmm. The year after you win, she and Clifford Ann Creed, who, by the way, Clifford Ann Creed has come up on the podcast an awful lot as well. And Gloria took that one with a birdie on the first is right. Yeah. What do you remember about that tournament?
Well, of course, it was my first win, so it was exciting. I had a lot of friends there because they were friends of the people we were staying with. And it just felt good support, and it was a great atmosphere.
The
club members were terrific.
Well, after those 2 playoff losses, you did have a victory up near the Illinois-Wisconsin border, Bruce.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Family Services Open at Mid Lane Country Club, where you beat Debbie Austin and Laura Baugh.
That was something. Laura Baugh, that was her first year. And she was
going to say, she had to be young then.
Oh, young rookie. And we were paired toward the back nine last round, and she putted up 4 feet away, and she said, "I'll finish." I said, "What in the world is rookie just finishing it from 4 feet when it really matters?" And she'd knock it in. I said, "Wow, you know, I mark it from foot." she was tapping in from 4 feet. Oh, I think she bogeyed one hole coming in, so that's how I won.
You were four back, I think, coming into that last round and shot a smooth little five under to win.
That was, again, one of those weeks and days that don't come too often, but you just let it happen.
So what was going on with your game that week? Was it ball striking? Was it you were making everything you were looking at? What happened?
No, it was ball striking. I was knocking it close and making the putts. So that's always more fun than sinking long ones for pars.
Yeah. Well, we asked you about the seconds, and you did have 4 second-place finishes that year coming into this event. So you were ready to win.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's a good point. I didn't know I had 4 then. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. You'd also changed your putter out for a mallet putter. Do you remember that?
I do. I didn't stay with it very long, though.
Yeah, I think what you did, you got rid of your mallet putter during this event.
Oh, good, I did. That's crazy. How stupid was that? You know, change your putter in the middle of the round.
Well, you won.
The tournament, yeah, it worked out. I used a Spalding putter blade. It was called a TPM-3, I think, and it was made out of gunmetal. And to this day, there is no feel like center hit on that putter. It was wonderful. So I still have it.
And tell us a little bit about the equipment you were playing at this time in your career.
At that time, I was playing Powerbilt, I think. Yeah, I joined Powerbilt in 72, and there were several of us on the staff. So, and I liked Powerbilt; they were great clubs.
They were good. Yeah,
yeah.
Beautiful woods,
Persimmon Head, and Powerbilt had the market.
A little different to today, don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, small heads and wooden heads. Yeah. But they had the best persimmon of any company.
Yeah.
They had the market down in Louisiana.
Mm. And I know, at least on the men's side, maybe it's true of your side as well, Betty, on the men's side, they're carrying those big orange bags. It was pretty easy to spot the Powerbilt guys out on tour. How about for you? Do you have a big orange bag as well?
Yeah, Halloween, yeah.
Yeah. Where's Betty Burfight? Oh, there she is.
There's the orange bag, right? Yeah.
She's over on 13, yeah.
Why orange and black? I don't know. But it was always that color. They never changed out. Like Callaway now changes every other week. They change their bag.
Yeah. And Bruce, you'll remember a lot of fine players back in Powerbilt clubs back in the day. Billy Casper and
played it. Yeah.
Fuzzy
Frank,
and Larry Mize
played with it.
Miller Barber, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of really good players use their equipment.
Yeah.
Yeah, the irons were so small at that time. We didn't know any differently, but today I looked at it, so I don't know how I ever hit them. They're tiny. Smaller than a jaw's head on a wood, just small.
Thank you for listening to another episode of For the Good of the Game. And please, wherever you listen to your podcast, on Apple and Spotify, if you like what you hear, please subscribe, spread the word, and tell your friends. Until we tee it up again, for the good of the game, so long, everybody.
Whack down the fairway. It went smack down the fairway. Then it started to slice just smidge off line. It headed for 2, but it bounced off 9. My caddy says, long as you're still in the state, you're okay. Yes, it went straight down the middle, quite a way.